Good evening, everyone. This is the beginning of Module 7. We have quite a showing here. Module 7 is entitled, What Makes You Not a Buddhist? And this is Talk 1, the introduction. And the book we are using is the same title, What Makes You Not a Buddhist, by Dzongtsar Jamyan Khyentsey. And since he is a realized tulku, we will address him as Rinpoche. So I'll refer to him simply as Khyentsey Rinpoche. So I think quite a few of you have seen last week the movie of which he is the writer and director, called Travelers and Magicians. If you have not, I would urge you to see it. It is available from Netflix, and I understand even the library here has a copy.
Waltham
does. Okay.
She found it.
And we might do a very limited lending of our copy. So our plan is to have this module go in exactly 6 weeks, next week not being one of them because we're having something different. And we're going to follow the book, which has an introduction, 4 chapters, and a conclusion, 6 weeks. And tonight I'll be using the introduction. So we're switching gears in a way. Maybe we're lightening up, introducing some humor, because Khyentsey Rinpoche has a great deal of humor. And as you know, he has a fantastic imagination as a storyteller and producer of magical illusions. But we're also getting right down to bedrock basics. The book is incredibly simple in its outline. It goes right to the heart of what it means to be a Buddhist. And with his sense of humor, he has said, well, what makes you not a Buddhist? So he's turned it upside down. So here's a book about the essence. I'm going to read just a little tiny quote to get you started. One is a Buddhist if he or she accepts the following 4 truths. All compounded things are impermanent. All emotions are pain. All things have no inherent existence. Nirvana is beyond concepts. And he explains this. I'm going to repeat this again. All compounded things are impermanent. All emotions are pain. All things have no inherent existence. Nirvana is beyond concepts. So there's exactly 4, and the 4 chapters of the book, not counting the introduction and conclusion, take up these 4 in order. Quoting, these 4 statements spoken by the Buddha himself are known as the 4 seals. Traditionally, seal means something like a hallmark that confirms authenticity. For the sake of simplicity and flow, we will refer to these statements herein as both seals and truths. Not to be confused with Buddhism's 4 noble truths, which pertain solely to aspects of suffering. Even though the 4 seals are believed to encompass all of Buddhism, people don't seem to want to hear about them. Without further explanation, They serve only to dampen spirits and fail to inspire further interest in many cases. The topic of conversation changes, and that's the end of it. Anyone want to go home?
I'm ready to leave now.
The message of the four seals is meant to be understood literally, not metaphorically or mystically, and meant to be taken seriously. But the seals are not edicts or commandments. With a little contemplation, one sees that there is nothing moralistic or ritualistic about them. There is no mention of good or bad behavior. They are secular truths based on wisdom, and wisdom is the primary concern of a Buddhist. Morals and ethics are secondary. A few puffs of a cigarette and a little fooling around don't prevent someone from becoming a Buddhist. That is not to say that we have license to be wicked or immoral. So then he goes on, what makes you not a Buddhist? And he simply turns them around. If you cannot accept that all compounded or fabricated things are impermanent, and so on. In other words, what makes one not a Buddhist is not being able to accept the four seals. So that's the complete outline for the course, to examine these four seals, to understand them as best we can, and see if we really can accept them into our heart and being. But the essence is subtle and not really so easy to grok. Everyone knows the word grok, right?
Mm-hmm.
Grok.
Oh,
grok. Grok from Robert Heinlein. Okay.
Oh, wait, we got a note. We got some notes.
No. With reference to science fiction writers.
Robert Heinlein wrote a science fiction story, I think in 1961, called Stranger in a Strange Land. And he brought the word grok into English at that point. And it means to not simply understand intellectually, but to understand something so that it's completely embedded in one's being and mode of existence. Is that... Anyone want to add to that? Does that do it?
How is it spelled?
G-R-O-K.
G-R-O-K, yeah.
Okay. It sort of has the sense of, someone who gets it, right?
Yeah, environmentally, yeah. Too, sort of. Yeah.
But gets it in one's being, not just says, I understand it and I can explain it. However, he doesn't use the word grok here, I just threw it in.
Oh.
He has other language. So actually, he begins the book this is kind of a funny story. Once I was seated on a plane in the middle seat of the middle row on a transatlantic flight, and a sympathetic man sitting next to me made an attempt to be friendly. Seeing my shaved head and maroon skirt, he gathered that I was a Buddhist. When the meal was served, the man considerately offered to order a vegetarian meal for me. Having correctly assumed that I was a Buddhist, he also assumed that I don't eat meat. Now, he doesn't really tell you whether he does or doesn't at this point. That was the beginning of our chat. The flight was long, so to kill our boredom, we discussed Buddhism. A little later, he picks up the story. When I tried to explain all of this to the man next to me on the plane, I began to hear a soft snoring sound and realized that he was sound asleep. Apparently, our conversation did not kill his boredom. So a couple of days ago, I was at Brandeis, and I was sitting in a room which at that particular point served mainly as a study hall because I was in between something, and I was working on preparing this class, and I had the book here, and there was a friend there, and he said, what is the book, what are you doing? So I started to tell him that I was preparing for a class I was going to teach, and then I started to mention the four seals, and he just got sleepy and dozed.
Maybe it's catching.
So,
yes, you're suffering from insomnia.
There you go.
So, should we see how many people we can lose?
They're still here.
So when we study the four seals, there are many subtle layers of mind to penetrate. Dzongtsar Khyentse points out that he's using words, and words are really abstractions, so they don't really tell the story, they're pointing to it. On the other hand, when you read this book, you'll see that he's not really just offering abstractions. He's telling a story. And the story he chooses to tell, it's not surprising that he tells a story. That's what he does. He makes movies that tell stories. But in this case, he tells the story of how Buddha came upon the four seals. And this is a very old story, and we don't know how much of the details we really have straight. Nothing was written down about Gautama until 3 centuries after his death. And in languages that are no longer spoken, and they've gone through many translations since then. But there's the story. And if that story doesn't work for us, then we'll have to make up our own stories. So I'm briefly going to comment now on the four seals, each one in order, and that's all I intend to do for tonight. As I said, we'll be taking each one of them up as a class after that. So the first seal says, all compounded or fabricated things are impermanent. Obviously, our body is impermanent. Our thoughts are impermanent. They come and go. Everything keeps changing. Ideas are impermanent. Religions are impermanent. Customs are impermanent. Everything is changing all the time. The earth is impermanent. The sun is impermanent. So change is going on every possible scale. And this is not a problem, but it's the nature of the world. This is the first seal. That change means that something has to die for something to be born. Some experience has to die for something to be born. Some present situation has to go away for something new to succeed it. Without death, there could be no birth. The two are absolutely inseparable. And this is no problem whatsoever. It's a problem when our mind wants to cling to something and not allow the world to move on. And that is what it means not to truly accept the first seal, that we are holding on to things and not accepting change. Yes.
Why doesn't it just say all things are impermanent? Why put this word compounded?
Ah, okay, good. So, everything is compounded. It's made up of parts. It's made up of parts, and it comes about because of previous conditions. Each of us comes about because of our parents, because of a social setting, because things happened. Any thought comes about because of things going on inside our mind and outside our mind. Everything, there's nothing we can experience that doesn't come from multiple conditions and will go away when those conditions are no longer present, including our bodies, including our thoughts, including each individual thing, including the present moment of our existence.
So I guess it's in there because that's to lead you to say, oh, so the things that, there is something that is permanent because all compounded things are impermanent, then things that aren't compounded are.
Well, can you find anything in your experience that's not compounded? Yeah.
I actually just finished reading this book, so I'm really excited about it.
You read the whole book?
Yeah.
Okay.
I read 3 or 4 books at a time, so I'm hoping I'm not mixing some of these up. But and what I recall, is he even talks about down to the atomic level, how atom has parts. Everything has parts. There is no, according to science yet, that we can find a singular something. Mm-hmm. Everything is made up of something else, and the further we keep digging, the further we find compounds. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if he's necessarily saying that there is a singular thing that's permanent, as much as staying open to the idea that there might be a singular that doesn't change. But the moment you have more than one of something, change is of its nature.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Just the relationship between them is of the nature to change.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's cool. Mm-hmm.
Well, what about gravity? Something like that. Even gravity is the cause of parts. But it doesn't change on the level of human experience, particularly, that I can see.
Well, sure it does. Well, sure. If you go somewhere where there's no gravity, then you won't have it. I mean,
where can you go if there's no gravity? On the Earth.
Well, okay, on the Earth. That's part of your answer.
Does gravitational pulls do change according to the mass of an object? And the mass of an object is constantly changing, not to the point that we can detect it. He's talking in the span of eons, not something that we may perceive currently right now, but it certainly is always changing.
Well, what about the tides? There are variations in the tides, depend on gravity, right?
Mm-hmm.
The pull of the moon.
Mm-hmm. Well, the tides are the results of gravity.
But they're changing. It's not constant.
Yeah, but are you talking about gravity is sort of an omnipresent law, a factor.
As long as the Earth is spinning.
Well, maybe we should.
The surface of the Earth, they've actually detected that there's enormous variations of gravitational pull in different parts of the Earth.
So maybe we should not get into too much science at the moment.
Okay, well, let him finish his sentence. Okay. Jeez, the poor guy.
Okay, 30 seconds for everyone who wants to talk about science.
Did you get to finish your sentence? Michael. Oh, he says go on. Okay. He knows when to stop. All right, good.
The point
smart.
Being made here is that whatever we experience is going to come and go, and not accepting the first seal means that we're trying to cling to things even though it's impossible to cling to things. That would be not accepting. And yet we do it. We do it in our minds all the time. It's difficult to accept that we can't cling to anything because everything is constantly shifting. Whether it's physical, scientific things or thoughts, anything, emotions.
If I could ask, it seems then that all concepts are conscious. However you say, compounded.
Absolutely, yes.
Okay, then how can you go beyond a concept? For example, emptiness. You could presume that emptiness is, I suppose, simple or omnipresent or whatever simplistic characteristic you want to give to it. But that's a language boundary. And it seems to me that we're stuck with the boundaries of languages.
As long as we're limited by language, yes.
Yeah, so what I'm saying is, if you say that something cannot be characterized, you're giving it a characteristic.
That is correct. You can't use language to go beyond language, other than to encourage you to leap beyond language.
Okay. Well, how can you leap beyond language and talk about it?
Well, we do, Mary.
Myself is through experience. Experience transcends the language. When you have the experience, you have the wisdom of understanding it without words.
We do it all the time, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, some of our things are mental constructs with language, and most of them aren't. When you see before you start to, unless you're describing what you're seeing, it's not language. It's not concept, necessarily. Until you use concept to categorize it habitually. The smell of garlic is not a concept. And we can smell it.
It's an experience.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, it's not going to be easy to get beyond it totally, and I think we're going to have to work on that.
Okay, so if I'm following that, experience is not compounded?
Every experience is compounded, and you can't hold on to your experience. That's what it's saying.
Your experience arises because of causes and conditions.
I'm sorry, because of what conditions?
Causes and conditions.
Yeah.
Without causes and conditions, you don't have an experience. You don't have a matrix in which you can experience anything. And so with the words, it's like the finger pointing to the moon. The finger pointing to the moon is not, obviously not the moon, right?
Mm-hmm.
To answer that question. Mm-hmm. Does that help?
Well, that's a symbol, right?
I mean, words are symbols.
Yeah.
So a finger pointing to the moon is just directing your gaze to go to the moon. You're going to the moon is not looking at the finger anymore.
That's what Kensei Rinpoche is saying here, that he's in many ways giving you concepts, but the concepts are something one has to go beyond, but they might point you in that direction, like the finger, which is not the moon. That's a very common analogy used. Yeah? Yeah?
Jean has something to
say. No, I was just thinking about this has sort of a destabilizing effect on people or me, especially.
Mm-hmm.
But when you think about change, you think there's different rates of change. So
yeah.
If you think of, say, the Ten Commandments or something, people want to cling to what they believe as a law, mm-hmm. and that should never change, but the rate of change may be centuries, but it will change. Are your thoughts about it, your acceptance of it?
True, yes.
Yeah.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And someday this planet may turn to dust and no one will remember the Ten Commandments or the Four Seals or any other concept, right?
So I was just going to throw in that there's a book called The Spell of the Sensuous. Is that right?
The what?
The Spell of the Sensuous. It's not what it sounds like. It's by a guy named David Abrams, and it's about this issue of perception versus language. He talks about the fact that language is an abstraction, and that through meditation and through different art forms, we try to get past language to an era, to experience of pure perception, and that we've cluttered our minds a lot by using language as an abstraction, and we don't even realize what it does to our interpretation of our really underlying perception.
Right, and we're going to make, and we're certainly this summer we have quite a few ideas about how to work with that. At the same time, it would not be good to disparage the fact that we can talk and think and use language.
And right.
We're not against, and write, yes. We're not against it, okay? It's just, what's being said here is that experience is beyond concept. We can't hold on to, basically, we can't hold on to things, and we try to hold on to things. We don't want to give up, even when we have no choice, which is unrealistic.
Don't you think that sometimes we don't know that we're clinging, though? Like, we don't understand that something's changing?
Yeah, that's the whole point. Mm-hmm. That's why we're pushing. That's why we're pushing.
No, just you.
That's why we're pushing into things that turn people off and puts them to sleep. Okay, so the second one. Oops, here we go. Second one.
Oh, no.
We're moving on quickly here because we've got 4 weeks.
This is the review.
Yeah.
This is just, summary.
This is just a appetizer here at the moment. So, the second of the...
What's that?
I see there's nothing appetizing about it.
That's good.
But say more.
The second one, as he words it, all emotions are pain. So an emotion is any experience driven by seeking happiness for oneself or seeking to avoid pain for oneself, which is something we do all the time. We want to be happy, we want to avoid being unhappy, and we are constantly driven by that. This is not the first time we've talked about that, obviously. So the second seal states that the drive for happiness cannot be fulfilled, that whatever we attempt to structure for our happiness, or the happiness of other people even, will in time fall apart, and the more we try, the more we're going to set ourselves up to fail, either in the short term or in the long term, and end up causing more suffering to ourselves and others. That's the first part of it, yeah.
But that's, you're talking about, you said the drive to happiness. I mean, I've had very happy moments, and nothing's going to change that. I may be sad tomorrow, I may be sad 2 minutes later, but there has been pure happiness. That's not painful. Maybe the lack of it isn't, but then you're extending this to maybe say it's the drive. You know, do you see what I'm saying? You're not talking about moments of happiness.
No, moments of happiness or pain without clinging are not really what he's talking about here. I'm not sure I would have... Yeah, so...
Sorry to interrupt.
No, that's okay.
It's very confusing about that.
It is confusing. I mean, it sounds like, you know, if you have joy, that's not joy, that's pain. Is this...
Well, he's talking about the pursuit.
The pursuit.
So that's what I'm saying.
Well, there's actually two things going on. One is the drive to attain it, and the second is even the happiness itself, if it's happiness for myself or whatever I conceive of to be myself. However, the second seal is going beyond that. It's saying that even the happiness, and again, I think it should be the happiness reference to self, is suffering, is pain. That is, if we look at the full scope of our experience, then what we've set up as happiness turns out to be painful, even at the moment, because it's because the half of our mind we aren't acknowledging is aware that the setting up to happiness has been the avoidance of pain simultaneously. In other words, it's saying that there's two sides of a coin, and even at the moment, you can't have one without the other.
There's clinging.
Yeah. The happiness will end. You also know it won't continue.
So there's anxiety in it, too.
So you're really not talking about moments of joy and happiness. You just said, we know it's going to end. No, there's a moment, you know, I had some happy moments today. I saw something quite exquisite in nature, and it made me very happy. Bing, that's it. Okay. I might be crying in an hour. I don't know. I won't be, but that's all I'm trying to say.
I understand that,
to diminish that there are pure, at least in my experience, there are moments where we have happiness and joy.
If it's pure happiness, if it's pure joy, it's not referenced to self, and therefore there's no regret when it goes away. And so that would be outside of this, yeah. Mm-hmm. If it's genuinely that, and the question then is it really something that that there's no clinging to? That, okay, this is happiness, this is unhappiness, and from some ultimate point of view, happy and sad are ornaments which it's a pleasure to wear. That's an ultimate point of view, beyond the four seals, actually.
So maybe you're just talking about acceptance of what is in the moment.
Acceptance.
What is?
Yeah, but it has to include not. The choicelessness of what happens.
You're not labeling it good or bad, you're accepting it and just experiencing it for what it is. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think that's fair, and I want to leave that open.
So we will have plenty of time to talk about this. We're going to have a whole evening just to dedicate to this.
Each one.
I'm curious because, I mean, what I'm beginning to get a sense of in this discussion is that I hadn't seen when I read this the first time, is that there's a kind of way that the emotions stick to us.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. Right? Because this feels good, and it's really easy to want it, or bad. Mm-hmm. And if it's good, I really want to hang on to it, even if I'm like, okay, this is great, hands off, but it's that nice that it's, you don't want to let it end in its own time, you want to end, you know, pull it a little bit. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Right, but when it's our own death, mm-hmm. or the death of someone we love or something like that, that's much harder to do then.
Right.
So there are, yeah.
The other thing to remember is all emotions are manufactured by us. So
it's manufactured, yeah.
They're manufactured by us. They're not given to us. They're not out there. They're inside here, and we mm-hmm. create them. Mm-hmm. So what emotions we bring to that moment are not real. The moment is there, whether or not we appreciate it or we don't like it. It's just there. So I think that's part of the point, is that as long as we feel this moment of extreme joy for what's happening in front of us, are we truly experiencing what's happening in front of us for what it is? Or are we bringing something that we're manufacturing into it? Mm-hmm. So I think sometimes letting go of that manufacturing and just letting go of the ego and letting yourself be in that moment, you may not feel joy. I hug my children, I feel joy in my children. And I can also have moments when I'm out in nature where I'm just not me. I'm not there. It's just this. It's incredible. And it's beautiful in its non-emotion. And to me, I really appreciate those kinds of moments. I feel lost in them. And I think that's that's really what he's trying to say, is let go of what you're manufacturing and just be in that moment.
I think that's well said. Are we working to make those moments, which would be a little, which would be to take them back a little bit? So,
what? Take them back?
If we're working to produce those moments, then that would put a stain on them.
But it's hard to envision from this point of view, like not being able to do that, not having had that experience. If I can recall, not to feel like it would be a loss to what it's like to be a human being, to give up those emotions, right, especially the positive ones, and to know what the alternative is, right, to be that kind of free, that kind of present. I know what it's like to be like this.
It's a choice. That gets to the notion of suffering. The devil, you know, in terms of, I don't know what I'm talking about, I'm really tired, but, you know, basically the thought that, why are we here anyway? I mean, why are we here right now? You know, you could be elsewhere. And yet, something about this is attracting you, us, for right now, because perhaps there is a question, a need, a doubt, I don't know, but that, because not everyone will actually come to something like this.
Most people won't.
It's because you really
often the whole state. And I don't think it's saying you're rejecting emotions. I think it's a way of that when those emotions come up, you can go, oh, there's that. There's joy.
Yeah.
And I'm not running to grab a hold of it. I'm not invested in it. I'm just letting it be there. And then at the same time, I'm recognizing that the joy that I'm projecting is not part of what's happening. And that's okay. That's what it is to be human. It's okay to have the feelings. It's just not grabbing a hold of them. That's all.
And the other thing is, if you're trying to later on reconstruct the joy, you're in the past. You're not in the present moment anymore. So anytime you're trying to remember that cardinal song and how joyful you felt at that moment, you're not observing or being in the moment of where you are right now. So you're clinging to this past experience. That's enough.
This is a pretty radical statement.
It's radical.
it's harder than even, like, we don't exist.
We don't want to take too much too soon. But you can see where this is going. It isn't fun. That's why they all...
But it's more about associating the... When we have an emotional thing, we cope and experience with our emotion. Mm-hmm. And then we assume that that's actually what the situation is. When in fact, there's something much more naked and fundamental actually there. So we're constantly in a state of interpretation. Rather than simply ultimately and truly being fully, completely present. So, I mean, I think this is a subtle thing, and it's going to require more reading so we actually you understand this is not just a bald statement out of nowhere. We actually, there's a reason why this is the statement, it takes place and what it refers to. And so I think rather than, you know, only speculating, we should all be looking at this and then decide, is this worth accepting or rejecting? Is it something we should discuss and explore, or does it matter? Forget it. It's too much.
Or is it a relief?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, two more to go.
Okay. Two more to go. We only have 20 minutes.
So, so even less, maybe. I don't know.
Less than
so,
that.
So the third one, which Michael was leading up to, is all phenomena are illusory or empty of inherent existence. And again, we have covered this before, and to say something is empty of, to say, first of all, to say that our notion of a self is empty of inherent existence is to look at this self, see if we can find it, and notice that any self we can find doesn't stay the same. It's different from every moment to the next one. There's no basis for saying that myself yesterday is the same as myself today, because otherwise I wouldn't be, that self would be something that's not even changed by experience. And if we look at it more closely, we also see that it doesn't really have autonomy or free will. It's, the self is continually being recreated according to whatever experience is bombarding us from our own mental functioning to things on the outside, tapping us or slamming us or whatever. So the self doesn't have really free will or any control over what happens. And there's a third thing, which is that it's not really consistent or singular. That is, it's required by convention that we act as if we have a self, so that if one self goes out and commits a murder, you aren't allowed to go into court and say, well, that was an impermanent self. I'm a different self today. I plead innocent. Our conventions require that we act as if there was a actual self instead of something that can, instead of a whole collection of different personas and roles that keep coming up. So in that is the sense in which we say that the self is really empty. And then when we look at anything we can experience, we can apply the same logic to it. And that's why the third seal says that everything is empty of any genuine existence. What's the word used? Inherent existence. At the same time, do we need to understand this? And Kensei Rinpoche says yes, because until we actually thoroughly see this, that we're not liberated, we're confined in some kind of a shell of not genuine experience, it keeps us from being open to everything. It keeps us from being present. It keeps us from being fully compassionate and fully joyful. So we're, as long as we're holding on to notions of the self or the selfness of the things we encounter, we're not really free. And this is the third seal. And we can spend some time talking about it because it's worth discussing. We've done so already, of course. And the last one says, enlightenment or nirvana is beyond concept. And at another point, he says it's beyond time and space, because time and space are constructions, they are concepts. So nirvana is, or enlightenment is something we can't say, I want to go out and get it. Well, we can say we want to go out and get it. We can study, we can meditate, we can do all kinds of things which are provisionally helpful. But then at a certain point we also have to give them up, because these are all things that we're doing because of our experience of illusory self. And Trungpa Rinpoche put it very vividly one time by saying, the self cannot obtain enlightenment because to the self enlightenment is death. And the self cannot attend its own funeral. It's impossible. So I know some of you are listening to talks of Anam Thubten, and every time he gives a talk, he's asking us to relax, to give up our expectation, to open up totally, to give up all the grasping that we want enlightenment, so that it can actually come to us, but that's questionable language, because it's there all the time. Yeah.
So is that not inherent?
Is
enlightenment inherent? Is that what you're saying?
The enlightenment. It's
yeah, it is inherent. Yeah.
Because it's beyond self. It's
it's intrinsic. Yeah. It's embedded in every one of us, just in terms of what every one of us has and Buddha nature is fundamentally
when you said
enlightenment.
The self has no inherent existence.
That's right.
That's everything on top of it.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Self is a fiction.
The layers on
self
and on.
Self is a fictionalized attempt to create an entity that in reality doesn't exist, but it's used as a reference point.
Okay.
And because the mistaken notion is not that we don't have reference points we use in our normal life so we can take responsibility for our actions, but we think somehow that means it's permanent. And that's the problem, that the thinking creates, the thoughts create the thinker in this case. Our thoughts create the thinker. They imply a notion that somebody's there thinking. But nobody is actually thinking when we actually investigate through our meditation practice. Which you can all discover. Everybody here in this room can discover that simply by practicing yourself. It's not like some big secret.
So I prepared a set of questions because I was afraid people would have nothing to say. In fact, they had nothing to say.
You should never worry about that.
Okay. So
we're free of worry.
So the purpose of these questions, first of all, they're not in any particular order. Secondly, they're not questions to say yes or no to, because each one has a flip quality of posing two alternatives. And what we need to do is to go beyond to go beyond having to make a choice if it's this or that, and see if that drives us into actually deeper insight and acceptance of the four seals. So I'm going to put this on the website, and anyone who wants to add a question. And our two teachers particularly, who are going to have to teach the next 4 weeks, can add to these if you want. But they're simply for the purpose of trying to move beyond our conceptual minds, this and that. And what's beyond the question? As opposed to, I'm taking sides, this one or that one. And a lot of them have to do with questions everyone's been asking here in the past. They were all coming up in my mind as I was working on the talk. So, if anyone wants to have anything further to say based on anything in these questions or anything not on these questions, we can just continue our discussion until we're ready to end it.
More basic question.
More basic one. Wow. Yes.
Just thinking about your lives and what you experienced today, for example, how do the four seals sort of, are they consciously present in your mind, or are you so accepting of them that you live without conscious reference to them?
Hey.
Yeah.
No, I don't understand them. Okay? I've lived with the explanations for a long time. I fairly often think about the explanations. Sometimes I get it as a spark, but I can certainly say that I have confusions about it. Khyentse Rinpoche, at some point right near the beginning of this book, says it's not as if you have to hold them in mind the whole time. If we actually get it, then we don't need to do that any more than you have to be constantly working on remembering your name. You know your name. So it's that sense in which he says acceptance means actually being them rather than thinking them. And we can do that a little bit. I'm sure I do it some of the time, and I'm sure it has practical implications some of the time. So that's as much as I can tell you personally. Or maybe it isn't, I don't know. What about you?
But it helps you deal with, say, emotions that you experience, that you question the emotion. Are you reacting too emotionally, or do you sort of, does that help you deal with your emotions? Just a day to day. I'm very down to earth, practical person, so I'm trying to envision how you experience things and accept your emotions, your reactions to them, or do you try to keep your emotions at bay?
Not at bay, no. I think for me, I guess, now that we're going to really work on these four seals, I'll focus in more directly that way. But for instance, thinking about concept, I've been thinking about that a lot. I think I mentioned the trip to the South and sort of this concept and looking at slavery and how people, how this happened, and asking myself, how are you a racist? Or, like turning it around to myself and thinking about what's a concept and how do I solidify my world all the time, like constantly solidify my world by liking this or disliking that or taking a view of people, certain people or whatever. We do it all the time, but we're mostly unconscious of it. So I'm trying to bring that more into, living color, so to speak. And, in terms of emotions, it's sort of, sometimes I just question things. Like, sometimes I notice where there's sort of a general gray feeling. It's interesting, because that can sort of slip beneath the radar. There's sort of the high points and low points, but this sort of gray, it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon, whatever. It's just this kind of time, whatever. So, like being more conscious of what is happening, you just start investigating more. Because when you meditate, you're not buying the trip, really. That's what it's all about. And you start setting up that pattern of questioning or looking. So you start to see the emotion a little more clearly, and then you question it or feel it or look at it. So you're not... It enables you not to be so gullible in a way. You don't get so tricked by your mind.
That's a good point, because we all have huge contradictions in ourselves. A gullibleness of not seeing our own contradictions and inconsistencies. And sometimes it can be very easy to see those things in other people. Mm-hmm. But spending too much time seeing them in other people isn't necessarily helpful, and going up to someone and pointing them out isn't necessarily terribly helpful, which is why we don't use priestly confession or other techniques like that, really. Each of us has to do the work ourselves rather than having someone point out, hey, you're coming on this way, but that's because you aren't aware that you're that way, and I can see it in you, and I'm going to point it out to you. That doesn't work necessarily. So we do have to start with being gentle to ourselves, and allowing, by being gentle to ourselves, we give ourselves ease to start to see what a contradictory bundle we are.
That's a good way to describe it.
I had a question on trying to get beyond this construct pattern we have in ourselves. And I'm wondering if it's okay to see it as this type of approach where, if I recall earlier at different meetings here, we tried to describe the sequence of perceptions from like an external sensory perception. It goes through the nerves and gets somehow connected to the brain, and then it gets aggregated into from unconscious to the subconscious to the conscious. And it seems to me we want to reverse it. We want to say, well, the conscious is all constructs, and the preceding layer is more constructs and constructs. And what we want to do is get down to experience perceptions without the brain involved with concepts.
I don't think you can't have perceptions without your brain.
That's what I'm leading up to. Is that
you can't have it? It's impossible. A rock doesn't have perceptions. It doesn't have a brain.
Okay, but can let me finish my thing. Is that so? Part of the whole point is, if we're trying to subtract our consciousness, our selfness, our awareness of ourselves, and get down to the raw experience without judgments or labels like joy or whatever, then if that's sort of like the regression we want to go through, then it seems to be an assumption that says, well, that's a more pristine and preferable part of experience.
But you're trying to create a very complicated construction, as if you could create a crane to haul yourself up on, which you're hold, so that you can hold the crane and elevate yourself. You can't do it by making... You're creating a super construction right now by doing that. At least it seems to me you are.
I'm trying to deconstruct that construction.
Well, I think that's the key point. So, deconstruction is about taking away the layers of prejudice and ignorance that fundamentally distort our capacity to really be present, to really directly perceive reality, and to experience it fully with body, speech, and mind. So, we find that the reason we are engaged in this is because we begin to realize that our patterns of thoughts and even just the nature of thinking itself has limitations. And we can't trust it to navigate in something that is beyond that capacity. In other words, the nature of reality is, as we mentioned, because as far as we can tell, as we examine our thoughts, they all have to do with relating to the notion that I'm here, that I'm real, that I have some kind of permanent entity. And so what we're doing is we're learning how to basically deconstruct that.
Yeah, so are we going against our very nature?
Our nature? Not at all.
We're finding our very nature.
It's the exact opposite of that. Our nature is fundamentally underneath all of this, these piles of encrustations that we build up. And basically, I attended a teaching last week where we talked about how it's just basically this is frozen light that fundamentally we're, the nature of reality is just basically completely open light and awareness. And our perceptions are so trained to believe that this stuff that we perceive as real is solid and permanent. And that itself is completely off. That's completely not the case. That we're actually, when we perceive things like that, they are either between dead and half dead. They're not alive. And so it's very interesting. So actually getting at the nature is actually what we're talking about. We're actually talking about Buddha nature. We're talking about emptiness, but emptiness is not just emptiness alone. We're talking about emptiness and luminosity, and we've touched on this previously. So we're going to bring this up naturally in the context of of these very topics. These topics, however, put us on the spot on some level. I just want to say one thing, if I can, about this. It's like, because you're a Buddhist doesn't mean you don't experience or have emotions. That's not what he's saying at all.
Right.
So, I mean, that's, it's not like suddenly we're shoving a cork up every orifice we have, and, you know, shutting down, right? I mean, actually, not at all. But we are actually willing to look, and as Emily is saying, is to really look and investigate where all this experience in these situations that occur arise from. And as we do that, we discover fundamental freedom. So this freedom is what we're talking
That's
about.
Where we're
when you begin to realize emotions as pain, we're talking about emotions as being a subjugating force where, you know, you're just becoming captive or hijacked by emotional patterns and experiences.
Right.
That's, and we've talked about that from the very beginning in this class, you know, way back. So this is what we're getting at. We're talking about kleshas. Remember kleshas?
Yeah. Oh,
they haven't forgotten that. I
carry them around.
So I just want to say, if you're feeling uncomfortable and this material makes you feel uncomfortable, then there's something there to look at. There's truth. So we're not teaching this to make you feel good. I hate to tell you the truth, but the truth is that's not where it doesn't always feel good, because we are breaking apart our shell, and it is uncomfortable. What can I say? You know, where there's groundlessness, there may be more freedom, but there's also, you know, we feel a clutching. So feel whatever, you know, be free to feel what's happening and say anything you want to say. Don't hold back. And anything you say, that's fine. You can bring it up. That's the point. And we're going to just chew on this and share our experiences and talk about it together. And it doesn't mean, you know, you have to believe something or you have to get it a certain way. This may all seem crazy to you, and then you may go on with other teachings and then come back to this later, and all of a sudden you say, oh my God, that's what they were talking about. So it doesn't matter. You know, you just have to have some sense of faith, I suppose, that you are willing to just try it out and work with it. You have to be willing to work with it. That's all you have to be willing to do. You don't have to come with an answer. You don't have to figure it out. You don't even have to agree with what he says. You know? It's about figuring it out for yourself. That's why Buddhism is not a religion. No one's going to teach you anything or tell you anything. They only can point the way, and you have to figure it out yourself.
And take comfort in.
Too bad. Good luck.
I was going to say, and I keep going back, whatever there is confusion, take key comfort that the path is the goal. I mean, the very state of being so white knuckled, oh, I got to figure this out. But when non-self kicks in, it's like you're grateful. You see comments that people make, it, and it's like you're grateful for the understanding, and you're compassionate because you understand that you were at that point too, where, you know, there was a self and a self-reference point, but emotions, when you realize there's no self, they just dissipate. I mean, they're just not even there. It's very, very liberating. I think you use the word liberating.
So I want to leave you with something which Kensei Rinpoche says here, which is that there are people who have experienced and realized these without any reference to Buddhism. And I think that's extremely important, that what we're talking about is natural and inherent in being a human. Therefore, the most value we can get out of going through these in the next few weeks is to see how much we can do it without reaching up to Buddhist teachings to do it, but getting right into where we are and what we're feeling and what we're experiencing. And that's not easy. It's going to be a big challenge to us as teachers and to everyone here to try to do that. But I think it's possible to do it, because if we start to reach too much into, well, we taught you this, we taught you that, remember that this, there's this teaching here, then we're bringing in too much authority and taking away our ability to see it directly. So how much can we do it skillfully on our own?
I was going to actually get gravitated to this question. Is there a value in performing rituals? You're performing rituals, Mark, when as a genuine Buddhist, are rituals merely empty rituals? I mean, the essence of truth is the essence of truth. So that'd be interesting to see what we have come up with.
You've already decided the question. Okay. Yeah, there's... It's got two sides. Okay, every question here has to have sides to it. Yes, rituals can be important in preserving the atmosphere and respect and the ability to keep our minds investigating. And on the other hand, rituals could be something you just do and say, I do these things, therefore that's my practice and it makes me a Buddhist or a Jew because I follow the kosher laws and or whatever. So these things are... All of these rituals are of tremendous value, and they're also could be big hindrances. That's why every one of these questions is not is to drive you into your experience of what's going on here with these seals. So they don't have simple answers. That's going to be true of practice. It's going to be true of. All sorts of things that we want the essence. He talks about the essence here as like tea. So can we have tea without the teacup? Well, Punna Rinpoche said something which I think is brilliant on that subject. He said, no, it won't do to pour the tea into your hands. You have to have a cup to receive the tea, and that cup is a cultural thing, and a Tibetan cup is going to be very elaborately, you know what they look like. They tend to, the Tibetans love to put jewels on them and decorate them and cover them with blissful images or skulls and threatening images and daggers, whatever. If there was a Zen cup, it might be a very clean, simple, yet very artistically contrived piece of ceramic with some very deliberate roughness to it, right? And then he said, maybe if we're Americans, what we're going to get is a styrofoam cup. I hope that's not it. But,
yeah. Super size.
Yeah. But you need to have, you can't have the essence without having something to contain it. And at the same time, you have to know that the container isn't the essence. So it's always a two-way thing. Mm-hmm. Shall we keep these, please? I'm going to put them up.
Oh, wait.
Yeah.
Oh, shoot.
Okay.